Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Helen Schulman's This Beautiful Life is a finely wrought literary novel that should come wrapped in yellow caution tape. Here's her review and her warning.
I've been on a roll this summer reading and reviewing good novels about family crises. Rachel Dawoskin's Big Girl Small, Dana Spiota's Stone Arabia, Kevin Wilson's The Family Fang. But this latest domestic drama is one I recommend with a big caveat, especially if you happen to be a parent. Make sure you start Helen Schulman's new novel, This Beautiful Life, on a Friday night, so that when you find yourself compelled to stay up all hours reading it, you can take the rest of the weekend not only to recover, but to think long and hard about the advantages for your kids of homeschooling, cloistered convents, kibbutzes, monasteries, and ashrams, or perhaps a semester abroad program in Antarctica. You think I jest. But This Beautiful Life is one scary story, made more so by Schulman's great gifts as a close and often funny observer of upper-class social customs. Here's the situation. The Bergamot family moves from idyllic Ithaca to New York City when the dad, Richard, accepts a high-level administrative position at a Columbia-type university. Mom, Liz, has a Ph.D. in art history, but she's put her own fuzzy career ambitions on hold to raise son Jake, who's now 15, and daughter Coco, 6. The Bergamots find themselves plunked into the world of elite private schools, which include kindergarten sleepovers at the Plaza Hotel and birthday party chartered cruises around Manhattan. In the contemporary comedy of manners tradition of a novel like Alison Pearson's I Don't Know How She Does It, Schulman, through Liz's alienated perspective, dissects the various cliques standing outside Coco's elementary school at pickup time. Here's a sampling. The Japs with the Japs, the headbanded preppy moms with the preppies, the stray earth mother in Birkenstocks with a baby in a sling. Next on the food chain, the caregivers, a couple of grad students reading Kierkegaard or Sartre and listening to their iPods, the small dark fortress of the Caribbean nannies. Liz saw a clutch of yummy mummies at the foot of the steps. She knew queen bees when she saw them. They were tall in their metallic sandals, their skinny yoga butts trim in their designer jeans. Only experience told her that when these ladies turned away from their gabby circle to place a cell phone call to their driver or decorator or art consultant, that the skin on their faces would be pure leather. Fraught with tension as that female gauntlet may be, the consequences of a social misstep proved to be much more dire in Jake's teenaged world. At an unchaperoned house party one weekend, Jake attracts the attentions of a lust-struck eighth-grade girl. He rebuffs her, sort of, but undeterred, she sends him a homemade, sexually explicit video later that night. Jake freaks out when he sees the video in the privacy of his room, and out of a mixture of fright and sexual braggadocio, he forwards the girl's email to a guy friend, who then sends it on to his friends. Schulman describes the burgeoning virtual disaster this way. By Monday, it was all over school. Kids were downloading it and watching it in the library. Kids were finding it on porno sites. It was all over the country, maybe the world even. So fast, just like that. Forward and send. It was kind of incredible how fast it went, faster than fire, practically the speed of sound or even light. Within weeks, the flourishing future that the Bergamot family envisioned for itself has withered, all because of a few impulsive adolescent finger clicks on the computer. What sets This Beautiful Life apart from, say, your average Lifetime Movie of the Week domestic drama is not only Shulman's closely observed depictions of the Bergamot family's collapse, but also her smart dramatization of how powerless we all are before the mighty, privacy-dissolving force of the Internet. At the climax of the novel, a distressed Liz cries to her husband about their children, "I don't know how to protect them. The genie's out of the bottle. It's in the air." That last line sounds like it could have come out of a 1950s horror movie. Indeed, as wry and entertaining as Shulman's social observations are, it's the totally convincing nightmare aspect of her novel that will keep parental readers up at night, wondering how on earth to pull the drawbridges up and shutter the windows against this most potent, invisible home invader.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed This Beautiful Life by Helen Shulman. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne Marie Baldonado, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Heidi Simon. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Alexandra Fuller caught the world's attention with her first book, a best-selling memoir of growing up in Africa called Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. It looked back on 1970s Rhodesia, the country now known as Zimbabwe, when white farmers were fighting a war against black rebels. It was a harsh and even tragic life where her parents lived through the deaths of three of their five young children. In that first book, Fuller's mother came across as a charismatic but troubled woman who drank too much and had a casual approach to mothering. Perhaps not surprising, Nicola Fuller always called it the awful book. In her new memoir, Alexandra Fuller looked further back to her mother's young life, an idyllic childhood in colonial Kenya, which produced a beautiful young woman, a madcap adventuress with a predilection for drama. It's called Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness.
First of all, as my mother said, we don't really have cocktail hour, we have cocktail days. And often stories would start with, well, there was rather a lot to drink, I seem to remember. And then this sort of tale of chaos and madness and hilarity ensues.
Alexandra Fuller says in writing this memoir, she discovered a mother she never knew, the person her mother saw herself to be, a character of high romance.
She, at some point, must have looked around and decided that all her literary heroines, Beryl Markham and Isaac Dinesen, had flown aeroplanes, and that this was something she did not have in her repertoire, and that therefore her biography was incomplete. So she signed herself up with this charlatan flying instructor and taught herself to fly.
As you describe it, as she's flying this little plane, you can hear in the radio back on the ground her singing.
She was singing, "Fly Me to the Moon."
You know, there's a moment that seems to sum up the funny side of her eccentricity, even though you are, as a child, often the victim of it. When you and your older sister, Vanessa, she dressed you up for a kids' costume party. Tell us about that.
So mother's fancy dress parties were always hell, and she had endured these awful fancy dress parties as a child. I think it must be a peculiarly colonial form of entertainment to slap your kids up in these awful, hot, inappropriate, itchy costumes and, you know, make them parade around in the baking sun. And so having learned nothing from her childhood, my mother forced ever more killingly imaginative costumes on my sister and I. And the worst possible one was she decided to dress my older sister Vanessa up as a rose. And then she dressed me up as, quote, "I never promised you a rose garden," in an insecticide drum.
Right. Now, wait, your sister is in a tutu, pink little ribbons, very pretty, very girly thing. And you're in a
I'm in an insecticide drum, yeah.
And a drum that had insecticide still in it a bit, I mean, on the inside, right?
Right, it was that incredibly toxic insecticide that you dust young tobacco seedlings with.
Why don't you read a little bit about that moment?
Mum explained that when she was in labour with me in England, the radio was playing I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, which was prophetic because when I arrived, I really was, as promised, not a rose garden. Mum has refused to waver from the story, even though I have since discovered the song became a hit a full year and a half after I was born, and therefore could not have been playing when she was in labour with me. She had yellow skin and black hair, that's why we call her Bobo, Mum explained, because she looked just like a little baboon.
And your mother just proceeded apace.
Yes.
She didn't apologize. I mean, she didn't say, oh, sorry, dear, I didn't want to hurt your feelings.
Right? You know, I think that one of the things about being raised British in Africa was you got this double whammy of toughness, because the sort of continent and place itself made you quite tough. And then you've got this British mother whose entire being rejects quote-unquote coddling in case it makes you too soft. So there's absolutely nothing standing between you and a fairly rough experience.
Well, your book does tell a tale of a sometimes quite dangerous and cruel world that you inhabited as a child. And part of that time was in a country at war, a war of liberation, rebels in Rhodesia trying to bring about a majority or black rule. But your mother and father were part of a colonial layer who felt they belonged there.
Correct.
Give us an example of what that really meant.
By the time the war was getting towards the end in the late 1970s, there were landmines frequently on the roads near where our farm was. The attacks on farmers were ratcheting up. So my parents didn't want us being on the roads unnecessarily because of ambushes and landmines. And I hadn't understood that that was the reasoning behind leaving my younger sister and I with a neighbor one fateful January morning when I was left to keep an eye on my little sister and she drowned. And this was just so heartbreaking. Dad had said, it wasn't that your mother didn't want to protect you, it's just there was so much to protect you from. It just hadn't occurred to her that somebody could drown in a duck pond. And I think that is one of the things about war, is that the common or garden accidents that you have the luxury to look out for when you're not literally under the gun, those seep away from your attention.
We do, in the book, end up back at the tree of forgetfulness, the banana and fish farm that your parents now live on and presumably will live out their days. There's a passage I'd like you to read that really gets to the beauty of Africa and how they see Africa.
The evenings out here on the north bank of the Zambezi River are tremulously beautiful. A shaky ribbon of blue smoke from a nearby village's cooking fire hangs over the farm. Emerald-spotted doves are calling, my mother is dead, my father is dead, my relatives are dead, and my heart goes dum, dum, dum. Frogs are bellowing from the causeway, the air boils with beetles and cicadas, mosquitoes and tsetse flies. Egrets, white against the grey-pink sky, are floating upriver to roost in the winterthorn trees in the middle of Dad's bananas. I won't let him chop down those trees, Mum says. The birds love them.
That's Alexandra Fuller reading from her new memoir, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. You can hear how her charming mother responded to this book and the first memoir at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green. Who likes the company of mean people, people who lie, cheat, steal? Well, author Ben Dolnick does, at least in fiction. For our series 3 books, he has this essay about 3 depraved, reprehensible protagonists. They are his absolute favorites.
People often talk about the characters in books as if they were considering who to invite to a dinner party. Oh, I just hated her. She was so mean. He's a bully. I didn't like how he treated his mother. There's something to be said for a likable character, but great fiction has a way of upending our ordinary standards. In life, we like tranquility. In books, we love tension. And in these three books, you'll find protagonists who you'd hate to meet in real life. You'd change train cars to get away from any of them, but who you'll love on the page. Philip Roth has made a cottage industry of unlikable characters. But compared to Mickey Sabbath, the furious and profane protagonist of Sabbath's theater, Roth's earlier creations seem like Winnie the Pooh. Sabbath is an aging puppeteer, reeling from the death of his mistress, ablaze with hatred for just about everyone, as he barrels through the stages of grief, stealing from his friends, lusting after his students. You'll wonder if there's anything good about him at all. But Roth's fictional machinery has never run at such an astonishing clip. The book is a ferocious delight. Legend has it that Malcolm Lowry's friends kept suitcases next to their doors, so they could pretend to be leaving town if he came by wanting to stay over. By the time you've finished this brilliant, semi-autobiographical novel, you'll understand why. Under the Volcano tells the story of an alcoholic British consul, Jeffrey Furman, drinking himself to death in southern Mexico. Hovering blurrily in his vicinity as he stumbles from bar to bar, the book evokes drunkenness better than anything I've ever read, are a half-brother and an ex-wife who may or may not be betraying him. Furman is an inveterate liar and a hopeless case, and his exploits might be too depressing to bear if Lowry didn't describe them so gorgeously. The book is dense with scenes that would be miserable to live through. Furman's lonely, drunken ride on a Ferris wheel comes to mind, but that are pure pleasure to read. Arno Strine, the narrator of Nicholson Baker's The Fermata, is someone you might report to the police if you encountered him on the street. Since he was a child, Strine has had the mysterious ability to pause time at will. You might imagine that he'd use this power to stop crimes or to learn French, but Strine, who's at least self-aware enough to lament his lack of virtue, is much more interested in undressing and caressing female strangers. You'll cringe, but you won't stop reading. These books may leave you craving a confessional, or at least craving the polite prose of P.G. Wodehouse. But they may also leave you thinking about just how different are our demands when it comes to reality and art. Disaster, depravity, disgrace. Ah, yes, just a few more minutes, and then you'll put down the book. Back to planning your dinner party, which, with any luck, will resemble fiction hardly at all.
That's Ben Dolnick for our series Three Books, in which authors tell us about books they love. Dolnick is the author of You Know Who You Are, and you can find more details about his reading recommendations, along with picks from a long list of other writers, on the Summer Books page of our website, npr.org.
The new novel, The Submission, centers on post-9/11 America. It's about an anonymous competition to pick the design for a memorial at Ground Zero and the furor that erupts when it's revealed the designer is Muslim American. The novelist is Amy Waldman. She's a former New York Times reporter who covered 9/11 in New York and afterward was based in South Asia. Here she is reading from her novel, The Description of the Winning Memorial Design.
The concept was simple. A walled, rectangular garden, guided by rigorous geometry. At the center would be a raised pavilion meant for contemplation. Two broad, perpendicular canals quartered the six-acre space. Pathways within each quadrant imposed a grid on the trees, both living and steel, that were studded in orchard-like rows.
That design was created by the character Mohammed Khan, an architect, a non-observant Muslim, an agnostic. Born in the USA, he goes by the name Mo. And yet, when the jury choosing the memorial discovers his identity, he faces intense pressure from all sides to explain his design and to denounce the terrorist attacks. As Amy Waldman explains, Khan stubbornly refuses to respond.
From his point of view, he keeps saying, you would never ask these questions of a designer who wasn't Muslim, so why should I have to answer these questions? I refuse to accept that I should be treated any differently than anybody else. I had nothing to do with these attacks. I'm not going to answer the questions. From some of the jurors and from many Americans, they're coming back at him and saying, things changed with this attack, and you do have to answer these questions. You do have to reassure us. And if you think these attacks were wrong, why won't you come out and say so?
There's also building pressure on Mohammed Khan to withdraw, to say, okay, I take myself out of this competition.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are a lot of people who take that position, including people very close to him and including some Muslim Americans who say, this isn't good for us. We don't need this right now. We have sort of fought so hard to a place of normalcy or acceptability in the wake of this attack. The last thing we need is another controversy. So, you know, if you really care about us, you should withdraw.
You know, this does sound a lot like the recent fight over what became known as the Ground Zero Mosque mm-hmm. in Manhattan. But the timing seems wrong for that. You would have had to have been working on this book for some time before that.
Oh, yes. Yes. I was working on it well before that. I had the idea initially in 2003 or four and started working on it probably in 2007. It definitely put an interesting spin on things. I went back and did some rewriting only because the book certainly plays off reality, and I have no problem with that, but I didn't want it to feel like a transcription of reality.
Mm. What were some things that you decided you needed to rewrite, given what you were learning?
Watching the sort of way that blew up and the kind of craziness, I think it opened out my imagination in the sense of thinking there are certain events in the book that were not in there before this happened. The specter of violence was not in the book as much from both sides or all sides. But I think just the way that kind of crept up around that controversy and the controversy that sort of bubbled up around the country, you know, the taxi driver who was stabbed in New York, there were desecrations at mosques, there are also threats from Islamic extremists, all of that kind of stuff, or the fear of threats, I started thinking about that more and that found its way more strongly into the novel.
What questions about sort of the discussion, the debate in America right now do you think you're trying to get at with this novel?
I think in the wake of 9/11, like a lot of Americans, you know, we were all very traumatized by the attacks, traumatized in a totally different way by some of what happened afterward in response. And I think there have been these questions hovering in the past decade of, what kind of country are we? Who are we? What are we justified in changing because of this? What does it mean to be America and American today? And then looking specifically at Mohammed Khan, even who is an American? And so those kinds of questions were what I was interested in exploring.
And this conflict you're describing escalates well beyond this architect and this design for the memorial. There's a group that springs up called Save America from Islam. There are incidents of headscarf pulling, people ripping headscarves off of Muslim women, and Muslim self-defense patrols that spring up. How did you start thinking about a scenario like that?
Well, I just started thinking the way in public controversies like this, one thing leads to another, and suddenly it's out of control in ways nobody could predict or necessarily wanted, and some of that is fed by the media. But some of it is just individuals reacting and acting, and that's an entirely separate thread I was really interested in exploring in the novel. I mean, if you look at this character of Sean Gallagher, whose brother was a firefighter who died in this attack, and he's become an activist but is also a little bit trying to find his feet in the world, and he really just pulls this headscarf out of impulse and rage and all these conflicting feelings and frustration going on in him, and it just unleashes all these copycats and then the self-defense squads in response. And I think that is sort of, I'm interested in how these things spiral and change through time.
I'm talking with Amy Waldman about her novel, The Submission. How delicate a dance was it for you to talk about victims' families and the competing pressures among the families in that community?
It was delicate. You know, I didn't seek out victims' families and someone to talk to, partly because I didn't feel right asking them to offer up their experience for a novel, but also I didn't want to be sitting there worrying, would they like this? Would they not like this? Would they be offended? Is this true to their experience? That would paralyze me as a fiction writer. And I think, you know, if you look at the last 10 years, they are not a monolith either. I mean, they are all kinds of opinions, all kinds of politics. They're human beings like anybody else, and they've all reacted to this event and everything that's come afterward in very different ways. And I felt like it was honest to try to represent that.
Hmm. You know, coming up on the 10-year anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and there will be the unveiling, the opening of the memorial at Ground Zero. I wonder if you'll sort of process that in a whole different way, given your immersion in this novel.
I think I will. It's somebody just asked me where I was planning to be on 9/11, and I hadn't thought about it, but I do know I want to be in New York. And it's strange. I mean, there's the whole way the novel is sort of braided with reality, I think will climax in some strange way in seeing that memorial open. So yeah, it will be an interesting time for many reasons.
Amy Waldman, her novel is titled The Submission. Amy, thanks very much.
Thank you, Melissa.
But now we turn the page to the latest selection in Tell Me More's Summer Blend Book Club. That's our summer-long series where we look at the mixed-race experience in America. In the science fiction novel Pym, author Matt Johnson creates the modern-day sequel to Edgar Allan Poe's only novel, the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket. The 1838 novel is a seafaring adventure where Pym and crew, much to their horror, land on an island near the South Pole populated only by black people. Poe's novel ends with a cliffhanger. The characters leave the black island and end up on the coast of Antarctica, face to face with a mysterious white creature. Matt Johnson's sequel picks up where Poe left off. Matt Johnson, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
Man, I tell you, this was one interesting book. How it begins and how it ends seem to be completely different. What inspired you to write it?
Well, I loved Edgar Allan Poe, and he has this one novel, and the novel is insane. It starts off in one direction where it's like a regular seafaring tale. By the end of it, it's off into this other kind of science fiction realm. At the very ending of the book, the main character goes towards Antarctica, and when he gets to Antarctica, all he sees is this white figure standing on the coast, and the ice opens up in a chasm, and the boat goes in, the whole book ends, and that's it. You don't know why. Like, even if you read the whole book, it makes no more sense than what I just said to you. So it was fascinating. The other part is the more surreal it gets, the more it starts to become sort of like him putting his racial subconscious onto the page. And it's a, you know, 19th century Southern racial subconscious, and it becomes absolutely bizarre. And it just intrigued me.
One of the things that was the link between his book and yours is this idea that there is a place on the planet that black people thrived and survived away from all the other elements of the world, racism, whatever, and your characters are in search of this place.
Yeah, I think that's, in some ways, it seems like an American fantasy too, this idea of this homeland that we all have. And for some of us, that's Africa. For some of us, that's Europe. And I think what I was imagining in part was a diasporan homeland, a homeland of the descendants of Africa who came here, something that was kind of unique in itself. When I read Poe's book, he goes to this island where everybody is so black, even their teeth are black. Like, even the water is purple, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And for him, it's a nightmare, you know, because he's coming with all these fears from a slave society. But for me, it ended up being the opposite. It became something utterly fascinating.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox. We are talking about the third book in our Summer Blend Book Club series. It's called Pym, an epic adventure novel, epic for sure, and author Matt Johnson is our guest. Let me ask you, Matt, because in the book, your hero, Chris James, and his all-black crew travel to Antarctica, as we've already said. There are some racial symbolism that are throughout the book. One of them involves something called the Little Debbie snack. little symbols. They keep popping up throughout the story. Let me ask you, would you mind setting up one of those scenes and reading the passage for us?
Sure. Here's a scene where they first interact with these monstrous creatures. They meet these 8-foot-tall albino Goliaths that live underneath the ice in Antarctica. And they find that they actually have some culinary similarities with these monsters. Pausing for a few seconds after my last swallow, seeing I didn't fall to the ground and meet a quick death. The creature ate what was left of the portable sweetness. The sounds it made, the groans, were loud, vulgar. They were appreciative, too, and the now excited snowman gathered over his buddies. The international sugarcane trade that fueled the colonial world, these beings had obviously missed that. I watched, struggled to be culturally relative and hide my revulsion as they moved the crumbs around in their mouths, their alabaster tongues glistening. They liked the food, I turned to tell the others. They were all nodding, uniform looks of frozen shock on their faces.
That was one of the more interesting things in the book, how Debbie's snack cakes kept coming up and up and up. Another thing that kept, as I saw it, Matt, as a strain throughout the book, your main character, biracial, you, the author, also biracial. What were you trying to show there?
You know, it's funny when I'm writing and I try to show something, if I try, meaning I have an idea of what it's going to be and I put it on the paper, it's usually horrible. It feels dead on the page. So part of the challenge with Poe's book, I felt, was if he put his racial subconscious on the page, then I had to put mine. And when I actually started it, I didn't think about the biracial issue. But as I was just kind of spewing all these things out there, in a lot of ways, it ended up speaking to my own kind of struggles with biracial identity.
Was it cathartic for you to write about it this way?
Oh, no, it was hell. I mean, you know, it's cathartic now because it's done. You know, like, no, it was horrible. I mean, this book took me like 9 years because I wrote like probably like 7 or 8 different versions of this thing. Basically, what I did was just kind of put my hand into my brain and threw it on the page. And so I had to redo it again and again and again, but to figure out what I even meant. And I didn't even realize that the book was in part about my own biracial identity until the end, you know?
Really?
Because a lot of times, you know, when you're working on a project, you're working so close to it. Like it's a painting and you're just working in this tiny centimeter block. And then eventually you step away from it and you start to see the larger patterns. And that's when it starts to become clear.
You know, one thing that probably is not getting through to people listening to you and I talk about the book is this. It is funny. This book is hilarious in places. It sounds, you know, we're talking about biracial and we're talking about all, you know, history and Edgar Allan Poe and blah, blah, blah. And yet it's a crack up.
Yeah. I mean, race is absurdity, you know, and race can be hilarious in its absurdity and its contradictions. And, you know, the challenge I wanted to do with this book was to try and deal with some big ideas that I was interested in exploring, but do it in a way that was somehow so entertaining that you barely noticed that till later, you know? And I wanted you to be kind of engaged in the moment. And like, if something is funny, you tune in and you get enjoyment from it. And I find that humor offers the same thing on the page, that it makes people tune in and listen even closer.
Absolutely. It was a fascinating book to read. And of the several reviews that I read, Salon.com had the best subtitle for your book, Pym, Negroes on Ice.
I actually wanted to call it Negroes on Ice.
Really? I said, this is perfect. This is just what this book is about, Negroes on Ice. It was absolutely hilarious. Matt Johnson, thank you very much for coming out and being with us. He's the author of the recently released novel Pym, as well as the author of a number of other books, including Drop and the graphic novel Incognegro. He is also a faculty member at the University of Houston Creative Writing Program. Joined us from member station KUHF in Houston, Texas. Matt, thank you very much for the book. Thank you for the interview.
Hey, great talking to you.